This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. With the latter half of the 20th century came the rise of a new land conservation movement in the U.S. Private, non-profit land trusts became increasingly popular among those interested in preserving land. Tiny Connecticut alone is home to 137 of these land trusts. It's the third most of any state in the country. Today, we're going to take a closer look at land trusts and their role in conserving land for future generations. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can comment on our website, wnpr.org/where we live. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Our guide through this world today is Amy Patterson, the executive director of the Connecticut Land Conservation Council. Welcome to our studio and thanks for coming in.
Thanks, John. Thanks for having me.
What's a land trust?
Land Trust, as you said, it's a private nonprofit organization whose central mission is to actively conserve land. And they do that either by taking title or holding it themselves, owning it, or by holding a conservation easement, which is an interest in the land that allows them to make sure that there's nothing done by the landowner that would interfere with the conservation values.
So essentially, they can be operated in, I'm sure, a few different ways, and there's a few different governance models, that sort of thing. We don't need to get down to the nitty-gritty, but maybe you can just explain how they operate exactly. I mean, who's running the land trust?
Well, in Connecticut, most of the land trusts are all volunteer, and that really it can be defined as having a one part-time person at most. But most of the land trusts that we deal with, the majority are all volunteer, and that just means that they have a board of directors and they have other volunteers to help with the activities of the land trust, and they run the show.
How is the land acquired?
Well, again, it could be through by purchasing land, getting the title to the land, and so it can be through a donation, or it could be a purchase. And again, that's if they want to own it outright. It could also be the acquisition of a conservation easement, which is a legal interest in the land that they hold, but the landowner still retains title to the land. And so again, it could be by purchase, it could be by donation, or it could be by something in between through something called a bargain sale, which means it's being sold for less than its fair market value, but something more than a donation.
Why did these start to become popular? I mean, why do we have so many of them here in the state?
You know, I think that you can say this for Connecticut and you can say this nationally, that with the realization that land is a finite resource, and as we see more and more development, people look around and they see their communities changing. I think land is a very defining aspect of a community. And people, whether they're professionals or not, I think they look around and they see that land starting to dwindle and they see the character of their communities change. And of course, there's all sorts of reasons why we need to conserve land. There's so many benefits, but really to me, the root of it and why we have so many land trusts now is that people really care about the quality of life in their community and how it looks.
It's interesting because we always talk on our program about the 169 town model, the fact that there's all these little governments pitted against one another for everything from tax resources to having wealthy residents who they want to come to town. Could you talk about some of the, I suppose, some of the tensions that exist in communities where there's a need to conserve land and an open space, and there's also a desire to develop and to build the tax rolls? How do these things play out in some of the communities that you work with, that you look at?
Well, I think it's definitely an issue in most towns. The way I have seen it play out is pretty typical, I think, in all communities. You know, a developer might come in, they might even live in town, but most of the time they come in and they see a piece of land and they don't have that same connection to the land as the people in the town. And then people look around and they hear about a development proposal after it's already been submitted for approvals to the local commissions, and then they have to react. And I think that with land conservation, the idea is to try and make it more of a proactive effort. So, I think there's a tension, and I think by conserving land or attempting to conserve the land proactively, you tend to avoid that. And I also think, just to your question about the tax rolls, there are many studies that show that there are tremendous economic benefits of land conservation. And if you want to talk, for one example, about a subdivision, which is a very typical development proposal in a town that will generate a lot of concern on the part of the public— all the studies show that when you develop land for residential purposes, the costs of that in terms of providing the infrastructure, the services, all associated with residential subdivisions, far outweigh the revenue that a town is going to get in terms of tax benefits.
Water's sore, you got to pave the road, you got to get the kids to school,
exactly.
Electricity, all of
right.
a sudden, all the costs go up. Right,
right. Exactly. And so there are, you know, very solid, there's very solid evidence that there are tremendous economic benefits to conserving land.
If you're involved in land conservation efforts in your town, if you have in the past been or you're currently involved in a land trust, we'd like to hear your story because we're talking about something that is obviously very prevalent here in Connecticut and helps to preserve an awful lot of open space. Well, one last thing before we get to Bill Bloss and Guilford, this idea of conserving land is interesting because we kind of think about the land in our town as it is as we see it today. For instance, 100 or so years ago, an awful lot of Connecticut was farmed. Those beautiful stone walls that we see cutting through the forests are there because more than 100 years ago, all the trees were down and those were open fields and the stone walls divided the farms. And now those stone walls are preserved, but in the middle of fairly dense forests. What are some of the ways in which land trusts consider how they're conserving the land? In what state we've decided to take this land and preserve it, hopefully in perpetuity?
That's a great question. And I think part of that comes with the conversations with the landowner. If they're going to hold an easement, a lot of that depends upon what uses the landowner wants to retain, what rights they want to retain, whether they want to continue to farm, and if it's not farmed at all, whether the land trust wants to make sure they have the opportunity to clear those some of those areas and unearth some of that prime farmland and use it that way. So part of that comes with the planning. I think that with land trusts also, they should have criteria in place when they are deciding what land to acquire. And so when they look at their own needs and their own criteria, then that will help determine how the land is going to be used. And really, to your question, so much of being a land trust is managing the land and making sure that the conservation values that they are seeking to protect are protected. And management is a huge part of that.
I want to bring into the conversation Bill Bloss. Bill's vice president of the Guilford Land Conservation Trust. He joins us by phone today. Bill, thank you so much for joining us here in Where We Live.
My pleasure.
So what kind of land is the Guilford Land Conservation Trust preserving?
Well, a little bit of a mix of everything. We started off trying to preserve salt marsh back in the 60s when salt marsh was gravely threatened. The feeling was the only good salt marsh was a filled-in salt marsh. And a group in Guilford said, well, you know what, we don't think that's true. And so we started off with salt marsh, but we've got everything from salt marsh to hay fields to meadows to woods to at least for what passes for mountains in Guilford. So it's a mix.
It's a mix, and it's also a lot of people who are involved. Can you talk about the scope of your operation, a lot of people who volunteer as part of this?
Well, I heard Amy saying that most land trusts are all volunteer. We are. We have a core group on our board of directors, but we have just numerous volunteers who take care of trails, who mark boundaries, who make sure that people are living on the right side of the line, if you will, and people who lead hikes. But also, most importantly, we have over 1,800 members, dues-paying members. And so out of a town of about 8,000 households, almost a quarter of the households in Guilford are members of our land trust, which is biggest nonprofit group in the town. Very exciting, very deep, very wide community support.
And that's what, in your mind, makes it successful. It's been said by many people that yours is one of the most successful in the state. In part, it must be because of the buy-in that you have within the community.
Yeah, we've been around for a long time, 50 years now. We're celebrating our anniversary this year, and we have we've really maintained a high degree of credibility, not only with our members, because we've made some very, very exciting purchases and acquisitions that have given Guilford really over 3,000, just about 3,000 acres of conserved land that we own. But we also have a high degree of credibility with landowners, people that we may do business with in the future. And so we've really, I heard Amy talking about the need to make sure that you have a relationship with people who might want to sell land or might want to transfer land to us, and that is 100% right. We've tried to really listen to them and work with them and try to make sure everybody's needs are met.
Elizabeth is actually calling from New Haven. Hi there, Elizabeth. You're on Where We Live.
Hi. I'm calling with a very specific question. I'm calling regarding the Community Investment Act, and I'm wondering about the impact on land trusts of the proposed sweep of funds from the Community Investment Act.
It's a great question. So, Amy, I'll let you tackle that.
Sure, I'm happy to. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi.
So the Community Investment Act is was enacted in 2005, and it was set up as a dedicated fund outside the budget to provide a continuous funding stream for four programs: open space conservation, farmland and dairy support, affordable housing, and historic preservation. And as Elizabeth said, there's been a full sweep. That funding for open space is for the Open Space and Watershed Land Acquisition Grant Program, and that is the backbone of conservation funding for land trusts, towns, and water companies. And it's also funded through bonding, but bonding is not a reliable source of funding, but the Community Investment Act Fund is. And so by eliminating that fund, you are taking away the only consistent source of funding for the Open Space Grant Program, really putting that program in jeopardy. We're very concerned about whether or not that program will continue on a regular, consistent basis. And that is so critically important for land trusts because I think Bill just kind of touched on that. You know, it takes a while to put a land conservation deal together. It's not just about signing the contract and going to closing. It also involves – so much of it involves working with the landowner and preparing for the deal. And so when you meet with a landowner, it's really important for them to feel comfortable that if they're going to be putting their property in your hands, taking it off the market and working with you to move towards a closing, that there's going to be funding in place to do that. So proposing a sweep of this magnitude, which is really unprecedented, we are very concerned about the impacts of that on the Open Space Grant Program.
Bill, do you have some thoughts on this?
Well, I do, actually. We have had some very, very exciting acquisitions in Guilford, some very substantial acquisitions that the Community Grant Program has helped to fund. We did a very large deal near Bluffhead, one of our kind of jewels, one of our signature properties, that we simply would not have been able to acquire without the state helping. The town helped a little bit, but the land trust carried a great deal of the weight too. But when it's a shared process, really we can do many more exciting things, and we can be much more flexible than we would be able otherwise. So Amy's right; it's a vitally important program, and certainly we hope it sticks around. We actually do, John, have something in the pipeline. Interestingly, right now we just did bought a piece in the middle of Westwoods, one of our signature properties, that we have a grant application pending right now with the state, and so we're hopeful that they chip in something to it, but we're concerned that if it is swept, if the fund is swept, that it won't be available. That would be unfortunate.
Are you talking with your local legislators about this?
Oh, sure, yeah. We have the good fortune in Guilford to have Senator Kennedy as our state senator, and he happens to be the chair of the Environment Committee. And so he is deeply concerned about it. Sean Scanlon, our state representative, and Vinnie Candelora from North Guilford are also aware of it, and we're working very closely with him.
Amy?
Yeah, I just wanted to add that, our concern for the funding for open space also extends to the other three sectors as well, and those being the farmland agricultural sector, the historic properties and preservation, and the affordable housing. I mean, this fund impacts every community in Connecticut. It is critically important to the quality of life in this state.
And do you think that for the fund to continue, that it should continue as a whole with all these four different elements as part of it?
Absolutely.
Yeah. We're talking today about land trusts and land conservation with Amy Patterson, who's Executive Director of the Connecticut Land Conservation Council, and Bill Bloss, who's Vice President of the Guilford Land Conservation Trust. We're going to be talking more about urban land trusts as well. Email us, wherewelive@wnpr.org, or find us on Facebook and Twitter, @wherewelive. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today on the program, we're talking about land trust and land conservation efforts in your town and city. Joining us is Amy Patterson, Executive Director of the Connecticut Land Conservation Council, who is very involved in all the 137 land trusts. There's a lot of them in little tiny Connecticut. Bill Bloss is vice president of one, the Guilford Land Conservation Trust. We're going to be bringing some other guests into the conversation, but I do want to get to some phone calls. Let's go to Kate, who is calling from Hartford. Hi there, Kate. You're on Where We Live.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I've recently been going to a meeting which is talking about the fracking pipelines that are going to be coming through Connecticut that New York has banned, and that the gas companies that are doing the fracking are going to be putting these pipes coming through Connecticut to go to the shoreline to then transfer it into liquid and ship it out for export.
Well, one thing I'll say, Kate, is there is a huge gas line expansion program that has been proposed for Connecticut and actually all of New England. And there's an awful lot of lawmakers who are pushing very hard for that, in part because there are needs for more natural gas to come into the state. I think fracking is probably the wrong word. We're not fracking for gas in New York. They've banned that, and there's no fracking going on in Connecticut. But your point about gas lines is actually well taken, and I'll put this to Amy Patterson. A concern that a lot of people have when it comes to conserving land is how it's going to be used, right? I grew up in Western Pennsylvania, and I've said this on the air before. When I go home to visit either Western PA or where my wife grew up just over the border in West Virginia, almost every available field is being fracked for gas, right? You see this happening all over the place. The fact of the matter is that we may talk about subdivisions in Connecticut being one threat to open space or a big box store going out on a farm, but I think people do have a lot of concerns with whether or not we talk about energy projects or new roadway projects coming through. How exactly does the idea of the land trust or land conservation movement help to interject into a conversation that has been so much about the need to get new gas lines coming through Connecticut, which are, of course, going to come through some people's open fields and space?
I think it's just about balance. And I have to say that these are new issues for land trusts. As you had said, they've been around for a long time. And so when looking forward, I think these are conversations that land trusts will more likely be having with landowners. Looking back, it's a little harder, and we have to do some interpretation, particularly when we're dealing with conservation easements, about whether or not one of these newer types of uses actually falls within the parameters of being a permitted use within the easement.
I want to go to Liz, and thank you, Kate, for your phone call. Liz is in New Britain. Hi, Liz. Liz, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning. I'm interested in the idea of an easement because I'm from Urban Oaks Organic Farm in New Britain. And we do not have a New Britain farmland trust, land trust. In fact, there is no zoning for agriculture in New Britain. So we're wondering whether urban farms, which are really an anomaly, and coming forward, lots more urban farms are springing up, but most people don't really think of urban farms when they think of farming. So what can be done? I'm interested in the Community Investment Act, of course, but beyond that, what can be done by farmland trusts, specifically Connecticut farmland trusts, to help an urban farm for which there is no local farmland trust?
Liz, thank you very much for that. And Urban Oaks does great work in New Britain. You have a thought on the local end of that for her, Amy?
I guess I need a little more, a better understanding of what help she's looking for.
Liz, can you maybe explain slightly a little bit more of the help that you're looking for?
Yeah. We need to buy out the land from the owner. We rent the land from the farm owner who wants to develop it and either create a parking lot over our backfield or create 14 houses and a road and demolish our 7 greenhouses. We are an organic farm that has been there since 1999. And we're very eager to buy him out, but we don't have the funds to do that.
Okay. Well, and that's good information. So, Amy?
Yeah, I think that there are, at least from my perspective, the program I would look to first would be the Open Space and Watershed Land Acquisition Grant Program through the Department of Energy and Environmental Protection. That fund can be used to purchase land. And so even if some of the Department of Agricultural programs or the Community Garden and Urban Greens program through DEEP are not appropriate for an acquisition, and I do think Department of Agriculture is another agency, obviously, you should be looking to have this conversation. but to definitely contact DEEP and see if this particular project would be appropriate for the Open Space Grant Program.
Could you say one more time what the program is?
Sure. It's the Open Space and Watershed Land Acquisition Grant Program.
Okay.
And we did just have this conversation as part of a workshop on community gardens and urban greens, where some of the towns that had come in there were disappointed to hear that that program is really only for distressed and targeted communities and is not an acquisition program per se. So, but the Open Space Grant Program is.
Thank you very much, Liz, and best of luck. I want to bring in somebody who actually knows a lot about urban land trusts. Marcia Caton Campbell is Executive Director of the Center for Resilient Cities in Wisconsin, and they work on urban land trust issues. And Marcia, welcome to the program. Thanks so much for joining us here in Where We Live.
It's a pleasure to be with you this morning, John.
So we just got a call from someone who works on an organic farm inside a city here in Connecticut. That's one instance that is maybe a bit unusual, but maybe you can talk about the role that land trusts play in urban communities that you work with, Marcia.
Well, my organization works in Milwaukee and Madison, Wisconsin, and those are Wisconsin's two largest cities. Urban agriculture is a big deal here. Milwaukee is home to Growing Power, which is one of the preeminent urban agriculture organizations in the United States. Urban land trusts can play a really important role, not only in conserving land that is designed to protect watersheds and that sort of thing, but also to help communities protect the very kinds of parcels that your caller was speaking of. In Milwaukee, we have a strong program going currently called Homegrown Milwaukee that pairs city-owned vacant properties with homes in danger of foreclosure, and there's a very strong urban agricultural emphasis to that, and land trust here can play a really important role in helping to hold that land. I think one of the values of urban land trusts holding parcels like that is that permanent conservancy role, and urban land trusts are fewer in number than large conservation land trusts. But they play, I think, an equally critical role. So I would encourage the caller to not only pursue all the resources that Amy mentioned, but also to look to see if there are either urban land trust partners or even a community land trust partner. I gather you have one community land trust in Connecticut, but those can also play that kind of function.
So what are some of the challenges for urban land trusts that are a little bit different than some of the large-scale ones that we've talked about, whether it's protecting a salt marsh in Guilford or a patch of woods or farm out in northwestern Connecticut? What's the difference with an urban land trust and some of the challenges you face, Marcia?
Well, there are a couple of issues that are really key. One of them has to do with what is in or under the land, which is a little harder to trace in an urban context. So we're speaking specifically about land contamination issues, brownfield issues, and that sort of thing. And it can be expensive to do the full environmental assessment. It's expensive and time-consuming. And so for under-resourced communities that are looking to preserve parcels in urban areas specifically for activities like urban agriculture, that can be that cost and that task can be really it can be challenging. So a lot of urban areas have opted to go with a grow from the ground up policy and raised beds and other kinds of things that help address those issues without having to completely remediate an urban parcel. And then the other issue is that in urban areas, depending on your proximity to the urban core, land values can be really high, even though the likelihood that a parcel might be redeveloped in a particular neighborhood could be small. And so the challenge is coming up with some money to secure the land, but that's a perennial challenge for any land trust.
And that's interesting. Amy, I want to ask you about that. The value of urban properties is so different because, as you said, even though there may be a low likelihood that in some cities a vacant parcel may ever be developed, the land price, because of the possibility of future development, is quite a bit higher. I'm wondering how urban land trusts in Connecticut deal with that. Maybe you can talk more about some of the urban land trusts that we do have in our state, Amy.
Yeah, and actually that's a really good point. And I'll talk about the New Haven Land Trust, which is really one of our more active urban land trusts. They're doing a fantastic job, and I think they do a lot of leasing of land just for that reason. So I think purchasing land can be prohibitively expensive for them. So they're doing a lot of leasing when it comes to operating their community gardens. They do manage 6 preserves, about 80 acres, a variety of habitats. So there is some land ownership there, but certainly purchasing all of it outright in the city can be expensive. And so they have to look to other options like leasing.
And there are other active urban land trusts in the state, but not a whole lot.
That's true. Yeah. And in fact, I was thinking a lot about this and thinking about the land trusts that I've dealt with that are in the city. And, you know, when you look at their property ownership, a lot of it doesn't necessarily look like urban land because the cities have a variety of landscapes. And so, for example, in New Haven, but Stamford, if you look, they have a lot of preserves that could really be in any suburban or rural area because of their location. The Wintonberry Land Trust, which is a land trust in Bloomfield, is a really interesting land trust. They're also all volunteer. They have a mix of farmland, suburban backyards, and urban centers in Bloomfield. They hold 200 acres of wildlife habitat, but they also manage the last pieces of working lands in the town. And so they have really done a great job of protecting a variety of landscapes in a very interesting town that has a mix of demographics as well.
Marcia, before I let you go, I have to ask, this came up in our program earlier. Our budget here in Connecticut, our state budget, is, well, it's facing some problems. And a few budget proposals that we've seen would actually provide for a sweep of the Community Investment Act, which in part helps to really preserve land of the type we're talking about. What's the support like in Wisconsin? How's the state government help you guys out?
Well, we have had in place since 1989 a fund at the state level, at the state DNR, called the Knowles-Nelson Stewardship Fund. And the Nelson in Knowles-Nelson is Gaylord Nelson, who was a former governor of Wisconsin and the founder of Earth Day. And that stewardship fund has been an outstanding source of support for local units of government and nonprofit organizations like mine to preserve and protect land in Wisconsin. We've preserved and protected over 280,000 acres in Wisconsin and with the assistance of the Knowles-Nelson Stewardship Fund. However, the fund is similarly threatened, and the proposal in the state legislature is that the fund essentially be put on hold for 20 years. And to do that would really decimate Wisconsin's land protection climate, and it would really, I think, harm the future of protected lands in what's an extraordinarily beautiful state.
What are the reasons given for putting this hold on this clearly very successful program?
The rationale that has come out of the state legislature is that we've protected enough land and that we really need to be paying more attention to a business development climate. Our governor is Governor Scott Walker.
Yeah, we've heard of him here. Yes.
Yes. Yes. So the climate here is one that is really putting a lot of In my personal opinion, putting a lot of public good at risk.
And what's the amount of money that is being proposed to save in the Wisconsin budget by cutting or delaying implementation of this continued program?
Of the Knowles-Nelson program?
Yes.
I'm sorry, I don't really know the number. It's pretty substantial. It's essentially a shutting down of the program. It's actually minuscule relative to the rest of the budget.
Relative to the overall budget, yeah.
Yeah, it's very small.
So you say essentially what I'm hearing from Wisconsin is that the state legislature and the governor is considering eliminating a program that helps you preserve and conserve land for a very, very beautiful, very rural state. It also has urban, yeah, urban areas, and in part it's just due to wanting to create a better business climate, as people say.
Yes, yes. The slogan has been that Wisconsin is open for business.
We've heard that. We've heard that here before.
It's less than 0.3% of the total state budget.
Okay,
the stewardship program cost.
Okay, Marcia, I really appreciate you spending some time with us and for letting us know a little bit more about urban land trusts and the work that's being done in Wisconsin. Thanks so much for your time. I appreciate you joining us on Where We Live.
Thank you, John.
Bill Bloss, before I let you go, I need to ask, how do you work in Guilford with other land trusts? Because I think this is a big piece of this. We've got all these little tiny communities sitting right next to each other in order to create some contiguous space, some sort of thought that we're all working together. I'm assuming you're working with people in other towns, right?
Well, we are. We have some very good relations with the Branford Land Trust. We've done some joint acquisitions, actually, of some land border that straddle the border. We're working with the North Branford Land Trust. We're working with the Madison Land Trust and have in the past, and Durham as well. So all of our contiguous towns, the property, the valuable conservation lands don't necessarily follow town lines, and so we do have to work cooperatively. But you know, even more than that, we have to recognize that there are issues of statewide importance that really. And Amy, obviously, and her group work very closely with us to try to make sure that legislators and the governor understand that this is a matter of statewide concern, and we really need to work cooperatively to try to make sure that the conservation interests are heard at the Capitol.
Well, Bill, thank you very much. I really do appreciate your time. Bill Bloss is Vice President of the Guilford Land Conservation Trust. Thank you, Bill.
Sure. My pleasure.
Before we take a break, Amy, I want to read you an email from another Amy. It says, as an art historian, it breaks my heart to think that the first American school of painting was devoted to glorious landscapes. What's being done to preserve the idea of landscape? Where do we have an undisturbed vista? There's no coordinated effort to make a sensible plan for conserving open space statewide. We're dealing with a free-for-all race to the bottom. Little pockets of open space are not nature. There's always houses just beyond the trees or traffic noise. That's a lovely little email. It also gives you sort of a thought about this, about the idea of the unbroken vista, the landscapes of Connecticut. What's your response to
it? It actually wants to make me want to cry. But I think it raises a great point. And I think to give the person who wrote that email a little bit of hope, we are definitely seeing, and I think we're going to talk about this a little bit more, we're definitely seeing a rise in collaboration. And you just touched on that with Bill. To the point where we're talking more regional in terms of our conservation efforts, looking at landscape scale conservation efforts. We have regional conservation partnerships in Connecticut, which there are about five of them, and they're part of a regional conservation partnership network. And they're doing really good things, and they are doing a lot of planning and mapping when it comes to identifying larger areas that need to be conserved, areas that span way beyond town boundaries and sometimes over state and sometimes over international, although right here in Connecticut, obviously, we're not talking that way. But I think that, to her point, people are thinking that way, thinking broader and more collaboratively.
And are you working closely at all with the Connecticut DEP on some of this? Because we've certainly done stories in our area about the importance of contiguous forest to some species, of contiguous open space to some bird species, that without a real landscape that is knitted together beyond the town borders, you really can't create the habitats that are necessary. I know DEP has worked with a lot of landowners. How involved are you with them on some of these efforts?
We work very closely with DEEP. We have a very strong collaborative relationship with them. And right now, DEEP is revising its green plan, which is its comprehensive open space strategy. And we are amongst many of the organizations and individuals that are providing input on that revised plan. And it definitely has an eye towards more regional type of conservation, looking more at qualitative rather than quantitative when it comes to the lands that we're conserving.
We're talking with Amy Patterson, Executive Director of the Connecticut Land Conservation Council. We're learning a lot about land trusts and land conservation efforts in Connecticut on the program today. If you want to ask a question or give us a story about land conservation efforts in your town, email us wherewelive@wnpr.org. You can also tweet us at wherewelive. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. When most people think about military drones, the iconic image of the Predator drone comes to mind, but the Predator is not the only unmanned military vehicle that we're hearing about these days. There are now land, sea, and even space-based drones. So what does all this mean for the future of warfare? That's our conversation on tomorrow's Where We Live. I hope you can join us. Today we're talking with Amy Patterson. She's the executive director of the Connecticut Land Conservation Council. We're talking about land trusts in Connecticut. Let's go to a call from Susan in New Milford. Hello, Susan. You're on Where We Live.
Hi. Well, I'm actually calling you from New Milford, Connecticut. I live in New York. I own a lot of land in Maine. I mean, not lots, but trees mostly. And I see that in Maine, the governor is holding up, and it's quite available, the information about this in the Maine papers and on the Maine public radio, that he's holding up funds that the voters, bond funds, environmental bond funds for conservation, and land trusts, like big respectable land trusts, and have grants, matching grants and so forth that they've applied, and they're supposed to get these funds, and it was all like sort of understood, and the voters approved this money, and he refuses to release it. He's holding them all hostage, and everybody knows it. People on both sides are horrified, and that this continues to go on. It's been an argument since last fall, and it's just horrible that somebody can do this, because it's an issue where a lot of volunteers and people with different political points of view have come out to work to apply for these different grants and to try to get these corners and sometimes larger pieces conserved, and the general voters approved this agreement, and all these people's efforts are being, you know, I mean, they're just being dissed.
And this is, yeah, and what we'll do is actually we'll try to get some links to some of the coverage from Maine Public Broadcasting about this. Susan, I really appreciate you raising that issue. And, you know, I just, before we get to our next guest, I should just say, Amy, that, you know, we were talking earlier about the Community Investment Act and the fact that we might lose some funds at the state level potentially. But here's the thing. Connecticut's done really, really well in preserving space compared to a lot of other places, from everything I understand.
That's true, although, frankly, we are doing well, but we're really not on track to meet our own goals. And we are lagging behind other states, John. So
our own goals were pretty substantially high, weren't they?
Well, I think 21% of the state's land area, and I have those figures, what that would mean. It's over 670,000. By policy, we set that by 2023.
Yeah.
I think it's a matter of debate whether that's too high. Some people would say that's not high enough, and some people would say let's ignore the numbers and, again, go towards the quality of the land rather than the quantity. And if that quality means higher than 21%, then so be it. It's really about what the state needs in terms of land quality.
It's really interesting because, again, you know, compared to what we see in Maine and what we see as far as support from legislatures or governor's offices in various places, seems Connecticut's doing well. But you say we're a little bit behind track. That's interesting, and it's very important to note.
Yeah, well, definitely behind track for the goals that we've set for ourselves.
I want to bring into the conversation Joanne Sheehan, who is the chair of the Voluntown Peace Trust. We want to talk about this community trust. And Joanne, welcome to the program. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So how does the community land trust model differ from some of what we've been talking about so far?
Well, let me say a little about what the Voluntown Peace Trust is, because it was put in trust by Bob Swan, who was really the founder of the community land trust, or as it is often said, who put the C in land trust in terms of what community is. But he actually created a trust to hold 40 acres of land in Voluntown in 1962. It was one of the first land trust leases that he wrote, although it was really very particularly for a community of folks who were active in peace work in southeastern Connecticut, for them to, it was actually then leased to the Community for Nonviolent Action. It's now 54 acres, now kind of reclaimed as the Voluntown Peace Trust, which is a conference center and a place that we have summer programs for kids from Hartford and programs throughout the year on Nature Connection and a lot of conferences and retreats and the like. So it's important that, you know, since 1962, that land has been able to maintain its purpose as a resource for nonviolent social change and sustainable living.
And this is a really early effort in this way. I mean, this is one of the oldest of its type in the country.
in the country. That's right. That's right. And Bob Swan is really kind of key to this in terms of the Community Land Trust. Bob was a pacifist himself and was imprisoned during World War II for refusing to go into the military. And he spent that time kind of as his university and his monastery, as it's been said of him, to study what was happening around land issues in India in particular, coming out of the movement that was developed by Mohandas Gandhi and particularly Vinoba Bhave, which was to take land and make it available for those who did not have access to it. And so Bob began that early work here in this country, and I think one of the significant things is that he went down south because the connection between peace and justice, between the peace movement and the civil rights movement, they really saw themselves in many ways as one and the same, worked with folks in Albany, Georgia, with Charles Sherrod, with Slater King, with others in that movement to create what was significantly the first large community land trust on a large tract of land called New Communities, which provided homes and farmland for black farmers, black families, who were not allowed, basically, during the segregation time, to buy at all, right? And so kind of stabilizing and providing those resources.
I want to ask you, Amy, is there anything else that's similar to the Voluntown Peace Trust in Connecticut?
You know, I thought about that this week, and organization came to mind. I certainly think, by the way, that there are certainly elements of what they do that all land trusts are doing, and I'd love to talk about that. But in terms of examples, I was thinking Billings Forge right here in Hartford. It is a nonprofit. There's land there that's owned. They have housing there. They provide employment opportunities. They have a community center. They have a community garden. It is so community based, and it's a very cool place to go to and see it in operation.
Yeah.
You know, there's another organization in Connecticut. It's a new nonprofit, and it's called the Creative Living Community of Connecticut, and it's really an interesting concept. And their mission is to create a shared, inclusive living experience for individuals with and without developmental disabilities in a farmstead village. And so they are in their earliest stages, but they're looking for land. They're looking for about 100 acres of land that they can use for housing for about 80 people, half of whom or maybe 20 would be with developmental disabilities and others, but they would have farming on there, micro business, again, really addressing community needs on site.
It's so interesting. And I want to thank you, Joanne Sheehan, for bringing us some of the history of the Voluntown Peace Trust. It's such an interesting project and going for so many decades now. I really want to thank you for speaking about it a bit on Where We Live with us.
You're welcome. And I want to say, to Amy, it's great to be on the show with you and to also see that there is a lot of overlap, right? I think that, you know, to get back to kind of what a community land trust would be, and I think a lot of the urban land trusts for housing share this, and Voluntown Peace Trust structure does too, which is that we're a tripartite board, right? So that there are the community members, like with Guilford, as Bill talked about, but that there's also those who lease the land. So part of the difference, and I think it also brings on part of the challenge, is that we provide that in a community land trust that housing is provided in many ways, or that small businesses are based there. And then so the lessees also have representation on the board. And then those two groups would choose another third of the board based on what skills and perspectives are needed so that the community involvement and the involvement of the people who live on the land is pretty key to the governance of a community land.
Joanne, thank you again so much, and I appreciate your time.
You're welcome.
And as we close out Where We Live today, we got a call, somebody who didn't want to go on air but asks a very, very simple question, Amy, that I just want to spend the last couple of minutes of the show going through, which is, if you want to put your land into trust, what's the most economic way to do it? What's the best way to do it? How do you go about it? Because someone might very well say, this sounds great, but what do I do next? So what do you do?
Well, I'm assuming that's a landowner.
Yes.
And I would say that they should contact their local land trust and have a conversation with them
about
what
their local land trust
about their conservation options. Well, if there's not a local townwide land trust, there's oftentimes a regional land trust. We have several regional land trusts in Connecticut that will cover the towns that do not have their own land trust. They also cover towns that do have their own land trust. There's a lot of overlap there. And call the Connecticut Land Conservation Council. I mean, that's why we're there. We're there as a resource to help you find a partner to help you conserve your land.
To help you find a partner and also to help hopefully find the money to defray some of the costs that go into it. And what are the costs that go into doing all this work?
Well, I mean, that's a sort of a complicated question, but at the end of the day, there are due diligence costs. Due diligence meaning for the land trust or the town that's looking to buy it, they need to investigate the property like any other real estate deal and make sure that it's suitable for their needs. There's surveys, there's appraisals, there's attorney's fees, there's financial advice. I mean, there's like any real estate transaction, you're going to have expenses. And so those are the types of things, and those are great questions to ask early on. And the other thing that when talking to a land trust, you should consider are the monies that you should provide to them in addition to the land that will enable them to steward the land to uphold their mission in perpetuity.
Because that's a piece of it. It's stewardship. It's not just the conservation of it. It's the actual stewardship of
Absolutely.
It,
Absolutely,
right?
Yes.
Yeah. And I guess a last thing for you. If you aren't a landowner, but you see your town changing and you say, my goodness, I really would like to figure out some way to make sure that my town retains the character that it's had in the past, what do you do then?
Well, I think not only do you talk to your local land trust, but I think you should get involved with your town and the planning of it. Get on a local commission, be a part of the Conservation Commission, or be a part of even a more regulatory commission like the Inland Wetlands and Water Courts Commission or the Planning and Zoning Commission. I think it's getting involved and really taking ownership of your planning.
Do you think people are paying more attention to these issues, to this stuff in towns across Connecticut than they have been
in
the past?
Yes, I think overall they are. I think some of it to some degree is still in more of a reactive role, you know, when they see a development proposal coming in. And that's why we treasure our land trusts, because they are doing this work proactively. They are looking ahead. They're seeing, you know, they have a vision and they can work with a town to really make that happen.
Thanks for teaching us so much about this world. It's really interesting to me and hopefully to a lot of our listeners. And we got a lot of people who wanted to get involved. If you want to find out more information, we're going to put links on our website. It's WNPR.org/where we live. We've also been tweeting out links at Where We Live throughout the course of the program. Amy Patterson is Executive Director of the Connecticut Land Conservation Council. Thanks so much for coming in and spending the hour with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you. This was great.
Our program is produced by Lydia Brown, Tucker Ives, Betsy Kaplan, and Kyle Wolf. Our digital editor is Heather Brandon. The executive producer of Where We Live is Katie Talarski. Our interns are Kelsey Bissell, Deborah Timms, and Jules Lefevre. Hold it, that's a name from the past. Welcome back, Jules. You can continue the conversation on our website, wnpr.org/where we live. I'm John Dankowski. This is Where We Live.